is Laura Waterman, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona, reading science fiction. Today, we read two stories from the May 1986 issue of the Magazine of Fantasy and Science Fiction. First, Point Zero by Terence M. Green. What I don't understand, thought Joe Nicholson as he watched the stripper cavort about on the stage, is where all these girls come from. I mean, they're beautiful. Why would a girl, any girl, especially one like this, Tess Truebottom, want to do this? She's gorgeous. Joe Nicholson was truly baffled. Baffled, but not sad. Baffled, but enjoying himself. His befuddlement made enlightenment seem a potential scourge. He brought his beer mug to his full lips, tipped it lustily, and let the cool, now flat brew drain fulfillingly down his gullet. He stifled a belch, causing him an extended blink, thus missing Tess Truebottom's latest contortion, wherein she displayed charms that might have stopped Joe's modest ticker. It was probably for the best. The music grated and filled the room. It was throbbingly unavoidable, pulsing, vibrating, cauterizingly electric. Tess's superb frame swayed to it, her breasts sheened with a vital aura of perspiration, her long legs twisting and extending. Joe was rapt. Tess Truebottom, the object of Joe's fascination, could not have been more than 19 years old. This fascinated Joe, too, her youth. The girls in the bars he frequented while on the road were always young and always quite attractive. Was the money that good? Was the thrill that large? Or were there deeper, less obvious motives? For a trice, Joe imagined deprived childhoods, failure in school, and the absence of a stern yet benevolent father in their lives. It would account for much, he knew. But the real question, Joe knew, was not what they were doing here, but what he was doing here. Yes, he mused, yes, what am I doing here? At that precise moment of introspection, Tess placed her hands on her sleek thighs, leaned forward, and gyrated her dark, long-spun hair in sensuous circles, letting it float web-like in alternating movements against the blur of spotlights behind her. And at that precise moment, Joe was certain that she was looking at him, right at him, at him. It was uncanny. Yet he never doubted for a moment that he was right. This was no deranged instant of megalomania, no subconscious guilt surfacing unbridled. Tess knew what he had been thinking, had always known it. It merely required the convergence of setting, people, and his inner musings, this unique synchronicity of cool intellect and latent passion to coalesce the moment into an epiphany. The music stopped. Tess remained frozen, her dark eyes still locked with his. Joe's mouth went dry. Swallowing was difficult. There was a smattering of uninterested applause, and she straightened, still joined with him in a private communion, her body lush and superb, donning the red satin robe that had been lying on the stool at the rear of the small stage. Taped music, softer, less raucous, filtered from the speakers to either side of her. Joe watched her knot the sash at her slim waist. She smiled at him, lips crimson as her robe, a vision of promise seen through the haze of blue smoke that hung low in lazy curls throughout the bar. She knew everything about him. He was certain. A cigarette appeared between her lips. In response, a male hand surfaced from the darkness and the haze, and a tiny flame flickered. Tess leaned forward, inhaled deeply. The tip glowed, then calmed, and she was gazing at him once more. The deferent hand receded into the gloom. Conversations resumed in low drones. The bar life continued, but not for Joe Nicholson. She was coming right for him. From across the room, like a heat-seeking missile, Tess glided purposefully, her robe rippling like a scarlet pond beneath a summer wind. It was happening. She was coming. To him. Why? She stood before him at arm's length, smiling. Only a few curious heads turned to see the company she had chosen. Joe did not inspire much in the way of salacious conjecture, so even those few, unrewarded by anything piquant in the man she confronted, easily returned to the rhythms of drink, conversation, and rock music. Smoke rings unfurled above the layer of vaporous blue that slid unctuously about the room. "It's time," she said. Joe Nicholson was speechless. Her words flowed around him like sap oozing from a tall willow tree. His jaw dropped and his eyes were as round as brass buttons. She sat down on the chair opposite him, leaning forward on her elbows. Joe's eyes tried to pierce the smoke to see the silken smoothness of her breasts, bunched together where the robe parted nonchalantly. The cigarette listed from her dangling, ruby-tipped fingers, a tendril of smoke weaving from it like a serpent sliding out of a fakir's basket. When she smiled again, he saw her tongue, and his heart raced frantically. "For what?" he said. "It's your time." He didn't know what to say. The tune on the tape machine ended and was replaced smoothly. He recognized the beat and wail, the Stones. "You can't always get what you want." Joe smiled to himself. "But you can, you know." Joe frowned. "Get what?" "Get what you want." She took a deep drag on the cigarette. He let himself smile outwardly now, if apprehensively. "And what," he asked, "do I want?" She exhaled slowly, the smoke issuing from some source deeper than within her. "It's not simple," she said. "It never is, never." He paused for a while, letting his eyes glide over her centerfold features, then returning to her dark, bottomless eyes. "Are we talking about the same thing?" he asked. "Yes and no." "Ah," he nodded. The last beer in his mug was flat. He drank it anyway. She waited until he had finished, then put her hand on his wrist. At her touch, his head filled with visions, an overwhelming, bottomless chasm of images, memories, dreams, of things undone, times forgotten, people ignored, of hatred and anger and guilt and resentment and aching and yearning and hoping, of roads never taken, moments not pursued, opportunities lost. There was a sensation of being buffeted by waves, of being washed up on a shore in a land where the sky was slate gray and the beach saffron and ochre. For long moments he lay there, face down in the sand, drenched by the salt sea that swelled up from unnameable depths and gasped for breath. When he finally drew it in, sucked in the precious air and swelled his lungs with life, he found himself gazing into the black eyes of Tess Truebottom. They were still seated in the smoke-filled room. "You see," she said, her cool fingers still touching his arm, "I told you it was never simple." "Who are you?" He didn't recognize his own voice. "Tess Truebottom, stripper extraordinaire, my name a marquee staple." He groped for what to ask next. Nothing seemed to fit. No, really, who? She shrugged. Even that simple movement was rife with sensuality. The sheen of the robe glistened and slithered over flesh as white as ivory. You were asking yourself that very question before I even noticed you. In fact, it was partly because you asked that question that I did notice you. You wanted to know where girls come from who perform for you in bars. Joe couldn't talk. This was too much. He didn't know whether to run or to order a fresh beer. He did neither. He continued to sit and stare at Tess, defueled by a rare combination of awe, curiosity, skepticism, and lust. In the background, the Stones tune was reaching a ribald crescendo. And the other reason I noticed you is that I've seen you before. But I've never been here before. Oh, but you have. Her dark eyes flashed brazenly. She crossed her long legs and he caught his breath. I haven't been in Cleveland for years, and I've certainly never been here before. Yesterday I was in Akron, 2 days before that, Dayton. Nearly all my work is in Cincinnati, but when I do travel, it's nearly always south. Louisville, Lexington, Nashville. It must be 5 years since I've gotten this far north. I want you to meet somebody. Who? You'll know him. What are you talking about? Meet who? When? She placed her long, cool fingers on his wrist once again, tripping his pulse into a less sane rhythm. Now, come with me. Why? It was the last word of resistance he could muster. She stared into the depths of his churning eyes. Because, she said, it's your time. It's point zero. Seizing his fingers in hers, she led him like a puppy on a leash across the smoke-filled room, weaving in and out between round wooden tables with peeling veneers, their tops besotted by wet rings from the bottoms of stale beer mugs. Peanut shells crunched underneath. The Stones broke in with, "I can't get no satisfaction." They were heading, he saw, to a table in the far corner. In the dim lighting, he could discern a man's shape seated there, a charcoal silhouette against a gray backdrop. Tess Truebottom stopped at the table and led him around to her side. He stared at the man seated there. It was him. In the dingy corner of the Honey Bunch Club in Cleveland, Ohio, Joe Nicholson, hand in hand with Tess Truebottom, stood and stared down at himself. There was nothing he could think of to say. It was surreal, the whole thing. It was him. It was definitely him. There was no question of a hoax, of a lookalike. These ideas scarcely touched his mind before being instantly discarded. He knew on the basis of more than mere looks. He felt the truth. "This is point zero," said Tess. He looked at her, then back at himself, and still said nothing. "I should feel something profound," he thought. "I should feel terror or awe or outrage, but I feel nothing." "Well," he admitted to himself, "almost nothing. I'm still curious. I still don't understand. But this is real. I feel that." He sat down, and a couple of seconds later, immediately across from him, Tess sat down too. Her white teeth flashed in the darkness, and she seemed, in a way he could not fathom, more desirable than ever. He put out his hand to shake the hand of the man who was himself. The stranger clasped it firmly, and he recognized the grip. "You are me, aren't you?" he asked. "Yes and no." "Ah," he nodded. He wished he had a beer. Tell me about yourself, he heard the stranger with his voice ask. What's to tell? I'd think you'd know everything. I don't, though. I met Tess only 3 days ago. I know we're quite different, you and I, just from talking with her. Joe glanced at her, wanted her, hated her, needed her. The carnelian robe was hypnotic and lush, a cardinal landscape of rich hues and wanton grottos. I'm Joe Nicholson. The man across from him nodded. I live in Cincinnati. I'm 43 years old. I sell B.F. Goodrich tires to auto dealers and private outlets from Nashville to Toledo. I'm divorced. He paused. I make a good living. He couldn't think of anything else. I drive a Dodge Charger, he found himself adding, surprising himself slightly. He paused again. Tell me about yourself. The stranger smiled, a mixture of compassion and whimsy. I'm Joe Nicholson. Joe had known this, had expected it, but the words, the sound of his voice, nevertheless, sent a tingle throughout his body, and he felt momentarily cold. He was suddenly acutely aware of the possibility that he might faint, sensing the room listing uncomfortably and hearing the stranger's words clatter in his skull. It's the alcohol, he thought. No, it's not the alcohol. He wished, in fact, that he had another beer, even the watered-down brew that he'd inured himself to for the past hour or so. I want her, too, he thought, turning his gaze to the mysterious Circe who had lured him onto these shoals. His desire for her filled an inordinate portion of his consciousness, all things considered. The Stones rolled another oldie through the bar's mammoth speakers, good times, bad times. The stranger continued, I'm 43 years old. I live in Buffalo. I'm married with 3 children. I'm a circulation manager for the Buffalo News. I make a very good living. I, he added, drive a Dodge Charger too. Joe's eyebrows rose at this tidbit. Why are you in Cleveland? He asked. Better yet, why are you at the Honey Bunch Club? Ask Tess. Joe glanced at her. How long have you been in this club? 6 months. What were you doing in Buffalo 3 days ago? Same thing I'm doing here, stripping. How could you be there and here? Tess moved her dark eyes from one to the other of them, then back. You, of all people, need to ask that. Now? I'm not sure I get it. I'm Tess Truebottom in more than one beer joint. You thought you'd seen girls just like me before. Well, you have. You've probably seen me. What's going on? This is your time. It's point zero. You keep saying that. Give me a straight answer. What's going on? Think of me as an agent. I bring people together to make choices. There's a perfect time for each of us to redeem the biggest error in choice we've ever made. That time is point zero. Nearly everyone gets their chance at it. This is your chance. She looked straight at him in a manner he couldn't fully comprehend. She was looking straight through him as well. Is he real? Joe nodded towards the stranger in the corner, the stranger who was himself. Tess leaned forward enticingly. Are you real? He couldn't, he noticed absently, see anything reflected in her eyes. She then slouched back, the robe parting seductively between her perfect breasts. He's as real as you are, if you want him to be. What do you mean? Do you like your life? Yes? No? Sometimes. That's not very clear. Mostly it's the pits. Does his life sound better? She indicated with only a glance the stranger in the corner. Joe stared at him, too. I don't know. I've got a good wife, 3 healthy children, a steady job. I'm not on the road all the time. I get to stay in one place, said Joe Nicholson of Buffalo, New York. And I could be you somehow, is that it? Yes. Why would I? What's the advantage? Do you like traveling? Do you like being divorced? Yes and no. Do you like hanging out in places like the Honey Bunch? Joe from Cincinnati, Ohio, shrugged noncommittally. Where do you hang out? He asked. I stay home with my family and watch Magnum and Knott's Landing on Thursday nights. You said your life was mostly the pits. He shrugged again. Yeah, so you can improve your lot. Tess can do it for you. And what's in it for you? That's the stumper. What do you get out of it? Do you get to be me? Is that it? No. Well, what it is, then? What happens to you? Tess's voice insinuated itself. It's more complicated than that. Yeah, I remember. You said nothing was ever simple. You see, you do listen. She smiled playfully, and he saw her tongue again. His heart skipped a beat. Clarify this for me, will you, Tess? I mean, lay all the cards on the table. Okay. All the cards on the table. She pursed her full, rubescent lips together, then began. You know the phrase, there is a tide in the affairs of men, which, taken at the flood, leads on to fortune. Omitted, all the voyage of their life is bound in shallows and in miseries. Yeah, the Bible, right? Shakespeare. Same difference. Get on with it. The tide is full for you right now, Joe Nicholson. As I said, this is your time. We call it point zero. Who's we? The Tess Truebottoms everywhere. What are you? What's a Tess Truebottom? I'm a stripper. I dance, I gyrate, I take it all off. I'm your fantasy. I'm every man's fantasy, even the ones who won't come through that door. You're just more honest. You want me. Every man wants me. I make them want me because I'm in the business of making men want me. I give them the dreams they try to bury, but that will never go away. I exist because you created me, Joe Nicholson, you and every man alive. I exist like a fever deep down in your lust-ridden imaginations. I will always exist there. I cannot be exorcised. You want my thighs, my lips, my complete lack of inhibitions. You want me. You made me. I exist as the possibility you will always seek, as the possibility that all men seek. We exist in a symbiotic relationship. Think of me that way. We're in the business of providing possibilities. It's what we do in many ways, Joe. You left your wife how many years ago? 10, 11? Because there were no more possibilities for you with her. And your life was, as you said, the pits. You can have his life now, your other possibility. It's your time, point zero. Joe was breathing heavily now, his mind racing with her words. And him, he said, what happens to him? It's his time, too. There are an infinite number of you, Joe, just as there are of me and everybody else. Back in Buffalo, at the Blue Ladybug, Joe Nicholson, who has never married and who is self-employed, who owns his own real estate appraisal business in Toronto, is waiting for you to say the word and you become him, she said, indicating Joe Nicholson in Buffalo. And he becomes Joe Nicholson of Toronto, now sitting in the blue ladybug, who in turn becomes Joe Nicholson of New York City, who's waiting with Tress Truebottom in the satin slipper in Scranton, Pennsylvania. It spreads like a wave on and on, and everyone gets another chance because your time has come. The tide is at the full. Why do I sense that I'm somehow a key in all this? Because, she said, you're the point of departure. No one wants to become you. You represent the least desirable version of what you could have become, the bottom rung on an infinite ladder. It all hinges on you, on your recognizing the opportunity for another chance. If you don't agree, then, she shrugged, stasis continues. The moment is lost, your time is gone. Tonight is point zero. This is it. It must be tonight, said Joe Nicholson of Buffalo, or we all lose our chance. His knuckles were white, all of us. The Stones were singing 2120 South Michigan Avenue. Joe shuffled his feet in the peanut shells. God, he thought, how I want a beer. Then he glanced at Tess, and how I want her, he thought. I don't know, he said. I don't think so. But you said your life was the pits, said Buffalo Joe in a voice turned shrill. You can change all that. It might be the pits, but it's my life. I understand it. He looked at Tess. Nothing simple, right? He smiled. Her dark eyes flashed, and she returned his smile. The stranger in the corner leaned farther forward, his eyes increasingly haunted. You can't let an opportunity like this pass. I own a house. It's paid for. I have $20,000 in bonds in a safety deposit box in Buffalo, just waiting for you. My wife is beautiful. My children, a father's dream. Then why do you want to change? I don't get it. Because I can have more. I met Joe Nicholson of Toronto. His life is infinitely richer, infinitely more varied. And he feels the same way about Joe Nicholson of New York City, who's vastly wealthy and successful. We all do better. Don't you see? It's to all our advantages. And I'm the least desirable, eh? Nobody said anything. And if I become you, then I disappear, and presto, you're the least desirable version of me again, only I'm it again. I'm the bottom rung again. I'm not so sure my lot does improve. Joe Nicholson of Buffalo was flustered. He was also becoming angry, and it showed in the way his face flushed and his eyes narrowed. Cincinnati Joe had seen it many times in the mirrors of motel rooms throughout the Midwest, usually after discovering that one of his customers had switched to Michelin. Follow me, Tess said suddenly, rising from the table. She turned and headed through an obscure hall about 10 feet away. Both men rose, unable not to follow. She halted halfway down the grimy hall towards the dressing room area and pressed the release bar on the emergency exit door to her right. Without hesitating, she passed outside into the night. They followed. They were in a service alley at the club's rear. It had all the trappings one would expect. Garbage cans and plastic bags piled high, litter underfoot, the odor of beer and hamburgers. Above, though, the moon was full and bright, and the stars glittered brilliantly. The alley was cast in silver and black. Tess's red satin gown shimmered and whispered,
drawing them to her. She glanced up at the round whiteness of the moon. "Hurry," she said. "There's not much time." "I'm not interested," said Cincinnati Joe. "You don't know what you're saying." He recoiled at the sound of his own voice turned ugly from the stranger's mouth. "He has to be here now." "No." "For God's sake, why not?" "I don't like you. I like me. I think it's highly debatable who's the bottom rung around here. Think of the money you could have. I think you're a scumbag, a pig. You make me sick." Even in the wan light, he saw the stranger's teeth glint whitely as he bared them. Then he saw the hand disappear beneath the jacket and emerge a second later, clutching the .22. Before he had time to react, before he even had time to voice a protest, even a bleat of resistance, the barrel flashed a horrible apricot color, and the explosion and impact seemed simultaneous. He tried to draw a breath, but could not. Tried to remain standing, but his legs would not respond. He felt himself falling backwards, felt himself hit the pile of plastic garbage bags and slide to the floor of the alley amid the French fries and the crushed styrofoam cups. He saw his own face, a crimson sash, a swirl of stars, his mother's face. Then he died, his mouth still open. Tess Truebottom gazed at Buffalo Joe Nicholson, at the small pistol he brandished so insanely, and needed to ask nothing. His eyes, gleaming wildly, met hers. "Now," he said, "I'm the bottom rung. I'm the key. It all hinges on me, and I consent to it. I want the change. Do it. Do it now." She glanced up at the black sky, at a sliver of cloud that had crept across the cold brightness of the moon. "I can't," she said. He stared speechless. His face trembled terribly. Then his hand. "Why?" he asked. His voice was barely a whisper. His eyes had dilated. "The time is past." He couldn't talk. "It's gone," she said. .0 is gone. Your time has gone. It can't be retrieved." "What are you saying?" "It's over. The tide has ebbed." She paused, staring into the hell behind his eyes. "You toyed with us." His voice was throaty, shaking. She shrugged, then shook her head. A flower of white-orange flame blossomed from the small pistol for the second time in less than a minute, and the report echoed hollowly between the damp brick walls. Between the milk-white breasts of Tess Truebottom, a bright vermilion stain appeared. But she did not fall. Buffalo Joe Nicholson's eyes widened in shock and horror and fascination as he realized that she was not going to fall. Instead, she shuddered, and the shudder caused the flesh to fall away from the perfect features of her face, and underneath, Joe Nicholson saw the face of his father, and in a passage of time, as long as it was short, the face of his father peeled away like lettuce leaves wilting in the heat, and he gazed numbly upon the face of his mother. From his mother's mouth, he heard the words again in Tess's voice. "I exist as the possibility you will always seek. I cannot be exorcised. I give people dreams they try to bury, but that will never go away." As he watched, his mouth agape, the flesh of his mother's face sloughed itself off in great, hideous flakes, and he was staring at the bleached skull underneath. Only then did the husk of Tess Truebottom slither to the dank pavement beneath. At the Black Velvet Club in Madison, Wisconsin, Harry Levy watched the stripper cavort about on the stage. He was experiencing a moment of rare curiosity blended with the not-so-rare pounding of his blood. He knew he'd never figure it. Why would a girl do this, he wondered, and where did these beautiful girls come from? I mean, he thought, they're gorgeous. From the loudspeakers came the wailing of the Stones. Time is on my side. Harry sipped his beer. We conclude with The View from the Top of the Tower by Harry Harrison. Stately, plump Sean Mulligan came from the stairhead, bearing a bowl of lather on which a mirror and a razor lay crossed. A yellow dressing gown, ungirdled, was sustained gently behind him by the mild morning air. He held the bowl aloft just as a voice shrilled up the stairwell behind him. "You'll catch your death," Molly sirened, her penetrating voice in full volume, capable of cracking a Guinness bottle at 20 paces. "But you would live in a Martello tower, saving money, you said. But no jacks and damp as a Kerry bog, then shaving on the battlements. Jesus, you'll be struck by lightning." Sean tuned out the meaning from her words, but the breakers of sound still crashed over him like waves of snot-green sea. He shaved too fast, nicking on bits of skin until the lather in the bowl turned roseate, whisker-speckled. With a swish and a grunt, he hurled the foamed water from the gunport, then hurried back below. Yet still the voice broke over him. Yet still he did not hear as he pulled leg into trouser, draped tie about neck, speckled bits of toilet paper on blood-spotted skin, fled downward, earthward, drinkward, past the 40-foot and pantingly past Bullock Castle toward Sanctuary Sanctus Sanctorum. The arches beckoned, and he obeyed. With the genius of years, the door was unlocked at the precise moment he pressed against it, pushed through, stumbled forward, leaned stout elbow on stouter bar, and breathed the blessing into the stout, expectant air. A pint of the black. "You've cut yourself shaving," Noel said in tones of utmost gloom, the only melody that ever issued from his barrel chest as he fulfilled the glass, bright yellow above brown. "I have that, and lucky not to have done myself from ear to ear with herself in full spate this morning. The voice of her, it only improves with age. Aye, they'll hear her in Wexford next. Say Balina and be done." Last wipe of Strigil, passed over and down, raised high and admired, first touch on tongue, first gorgeous glottis gorging, first sight of life returned, pax vobiscum, pax pumanum. For Portugal, earth was a flowing font of language. He had been the first student, the only student on his home world, dark planet of an ice-blue star on the far side of the galactic lens, to master the difficult art of mental projection. When Lacatrop had been possessed by the alien intelligence, Portakal alone had talked with him and had discovered what had happened. Through mental projection, the mind could travel, could occupy the body of another intelligent being, no matter what its form, no matter what distant world it inhabited. Before Lacatrop's possessor had left, bored by the sluggish, cold world and the almost total lack of interest in his presence, Portakal had learned the projection technique. The tachyon source could be grasped, understood, utilized only by force of will alone, and his will was strong, driven by his need to communicate in other than the muffled tones of his race. Sluggish and thick, they oozed along at the bottom of their dense, chill atmosphere, where liquid and gas merged and changed, speaking only with the greatest effort against the pressure of thousands of miles of gas above. For this reason, their language was stripped and truncated, bare and unadorned, brief and brutal. He was the only linguist, self-taught and lonely, for who needs linguists when the language contains only 112 words? What paradise this green, warm world of Earth! Twice before, Portugal had journeyed here, entered the mind of Earth-dwellers to speak and revel in the licking of language, to learn and remember. It did not bother him that he had to walk with 2 legs instead of 20, lacked tentacles and extra eyes on his fingertips, nor did he even miss the pingal organs that made copulation so intriguing. No sacrifice was too great when it aided his linguistic research. It bothered him slightly that his first research attempt had ended almost as quickly as it had begun. His spoken Zulu was quite primitive, since the unfortunate body he had controlled had been burned as a witch soon after his arrival. His second occupation in Japan had been more successful, since he had concealed his presence most of the time. His reluctant host, a geisha girl, had lived long enough for him to completely master her language until he had thoughtlessly walked her in front of a bullet train while preoccupied with sister, brother, shimai, kudal interrelationships. Now, he was ready to research again. His mnemonic notes on Japanese had been scratched into steel-hard ice by his ventral claw. He clacked 10 or 11 sets of teeth with pleasure as he took up the tachyon source, reached out with his mind, envisioned once again the blue-green sphere of Earth. Sean Mulligan felt dizzy after only 6 pints and closed his eyes for an instant. When he opened them again, Portugal looked out. "Sean, me old darling," Patsy Kelly said. "Sure, and you're not dozing off in the middle of the afternoon. Sure, and you're not." Sean blinked blurrily in his direction across the sea of pints, smacked his lips and said, "Biro nihong kudasai." "None of that now," Seamus said, shaking an admonitory finger as thick as another man's wrist, for he was a great oak of a man, hard strengthened by a life on the building sites. "None of that. You know that I am ill-educated and don't have the Irish, so none of your stout-fueled, priest-trained attempts at superiority." Portugal rustled around in the synapses of the alcohol-dulled brain he now possessed. Oh, foolish error. He was speaking Japanese, not the local language. What did they speak here? Oh, yes, here it was. He sighed as he sank into the linguistic pool, splashed about with the correct words, then spoke. He would explain his earlier mistake, so this body would not be stake-burned like the other. "I am Portugal, from a distant world across the galaxy. I bring you greetings." "Jesus, he's pissed already," Patsy Kelly said with some amazement. "He's been into the whiskey at home. That's what he's been doing. You will obey my orders and will speak as I order you to if you value your drinking companion's continued existence." He was dimly aware of pain on posterior and extremities as he struck the hard surface. "And don't come back until you're sober," Noel called after him. "Shameful, a man of your age, not to say education, in his cups this hour of the day." The pub door closed, and Portugal pulled himself up from among the tartered crisp packets, fag ends, and dog turds. He cursed in Japanese, because that came easiest at the moment. What kind of people were these that didn't know the difference between host and occupier? Disgraceful. Perhaps it was the only occupants of the sake parlor who thought that way, for he knew that strong drink did strange things to these soft bodies. He would seek one of superior intelligence to converse with. With slow pace, he went along the street, using his newfound skills to spell out the words that swarmed on all sides. A glass window, the Jolly Friar, fish and chips, a locked door below, closed for lunch, interesting. Another establishment, a signboard, punctures repaired. On the other side, it read, punctures repaired. He made a mental note of the unusual spelling variations. Then, a larger building made of dressed stone, set back from the road, coming to a point on top, door opened invitingly into the dark interior. He entered, saw rows of flickering flames. A man all in dark approached. "I salute you, son of a distant world," Portugal said, "and bring you greetings from the other side of the galaxy." Father Flynn glowered along the length of his impressive nose. "Drinking again, Sean Mulligan? The curse of the Irish it is, and you not to mass since the Battle of the Boyne. You'll die unshriven, man. You will plunge straight through the bottom of purgatory and into hell before you even know you're dead." "I bid silence and order attention," Portugal said testily. It had been far better in Japan. "My name is Portugal. You cannot see the sun of my planet from here. Yet, I assure you, the only assurances I want from you, you blackguard, is a confession of your sins long overdue. You are the burden that your poor wife must bear, the shame of her coming alone here on Sunday. Will you listen to me? I will not, but I will pray for you, miserable sinner that you are." This was unbearable, unbelievable. Portugal turned the body on its heel and stamped out into the spring sunshine again. But the sun had vanished suddenly, and chill rain came down, drenching him in an instant. He shivered and paid it no heed. There was obviously something wrong with these people. They could not all be hard of hearing. Perhaps he had picked the wrong host for his operations. He slumped against the wall and looked at those who hurried by in the driving rain. Could he make the effort of will to leave this host and find another? He had never done it before. He could only try. He waited until there was a knot of people close by, then willed it strongly. Nothing happened. He would have to make the most of it. This creature would have to do. He would return to the first place of drinking and attempt communication again. Yet when he ordered the body forward, it did not move. Impossible. His was the will that had spanned light years, the strength that manipulated tachyons. This miserable earthling, he was aware of it lurking unhappily in a far corner of the cerebellum, could not fight against his strength of purpose. Then why couldn't he move? He spoke aloud, the only way he could communicate with the subject mind. "Desist, I order it. We will return to the arches." "We will go to the center of regional government," he said in a deep and resonant voice. Portugal was astonished. Those were not his words, or even those of his host. "Then what? Who are you?" he shouted. "I see you there, lurking in a twisted whirl of the medulla oblongata. Step forward and present yourself." An old woman stumbled by, clinging to her umbrella, took one look at Sean Mulligan, crossed herself, and tottered even faster. "I am Minkatel of the Blah Blah. Oh, Earthman, I bring you greetings from beyond the stores." "Get out of his brain," Portugal ordered. "I was here first." Sean's eyes crossed as each of the aliens controlled one eye to look at the other. "It cannot be true," Minkle wailed in stentorian tones. "My mentor grew old and died, teaching me the astral projection technique. I have expanded all of my energy to occupy this mind. You must leave." "Tough titty," Portakal growled. "Finders keepers, losers weepers. Now crawl away, alien sod, because I have important linguistic research to do." Sean Mulligan danced in circles, limbs flopping as the two alien presences battled for control, then splashed down into a puddle. "I care not a pistol for your research," Mintkill thundered. "Mine is a dying world, beset by accelerated entropy. Our fuel is running out. I am here on a galactic rescue mission. I must talk to the authorities, offer them scientific knowledge in exchange for atomic fuel. Unless a cargo of U-235 is shipped out to us soonest, we go down the galactic plug hole." "Goodbye," Portakal sneered unfeelingly. "No one has ever heard of your backward planet in any case, so no one will miss it." Sean's voice cracked with rage as Mintical gnarled his answer. Then he gargled incoherently as both aliens struggled for verbal control. As this mental battle raged, Sean found that he could see dimly, as through a heavy fog, and when he tried to walk, he began to stumble forward. In their urge to speak, the alien presences had abandoned control of his body. With shuffling feet, he turned in a circle. There would be no welcome at the arches today, and toured towards Mulroney's. Walking slowly, talking to himself with high-pitched squeals and rattling gurgles through the door and to the bar. "That's a wicked cough you have there," Mulroney said, setting one before him. "It's that Martello Tower and all the dampness. Put in the central heating, that's what you must do, though I see difficulties in drilling through the granite walls, surely 20 feet thick." Sean raised the pint slowly, then half-drained it, taking all the time, quite splashily, as the stout gurgled past his vocal cords. Mulroney went off to serve another customer, as Mintical spoke in dark tones. "A compromise, then. Give me leave to speak. You would not wish the death of a planet upon your conscience, would you?" "I have no conscience, most impractical at the great pressures under which we live." "Then I appeal to your intelligence and curiosity. Merely let me go to the national dictator or other qualified government official and make my arrangements for the U-235. That creature will undoubtedly speak the local language better than our host, so your studies will quicken." "What's in it for me?" Portakal asked, intrigued. "The gratitude of an entire world. With that and a stretzel, I can buy a kretzel. You can do better than that." "I have nothing else to offer." "What about your own language? Might be interesting. How would you say, breasts all perfume, yes, and his heart was going like mad, and yes, I will, yes." "No fungrugala, blah." "Forget it. That's not a language. It's a throat disease." While they talked, Sean raised a shaky finger to Mulroney, fumbled pound notes to the sticky bar, downed the fresh point, and reached for another, even fresher one. "You are so unjust," Mintical whimpered, "and selfish. Would you have an entire world die because of your neglect?" "Damn right," Portakal responded dimly. "Galaxies like grains of sand, stars like dust or holes in a blanket, couldn't care less." His voice trickled away, then returned with an effort. "I find it almost impossible to talk. What's happening?" "I'll tell you what is happening," Mintical answered, his fear forcing the word through the cloying blanket of incomprehension. "While we have been distracted, this host creature has been purchasing large amounts of biological poison. The deadly liquid has seeped into the synapses of his brain and is disconnecting them one by one. I am losing control. It will drive us out." "It will kill itself at the same time," Portakal squeaked. "We must stop it." They each took one arm and clamped the hands tight upon the bar, stared glassily ahead as they battled for control. "So You've stopped talking to yourself at last, Mulroney said carefully, polishing a glass. Drunk yourself sober, you have. Would you like one for the road? I want, Mintical said deeply. No more, squeaked Portugal. Your voice changing? Not at your age. Must be your cold. Better get into bed before it turns into the flux. Legs spread wide, hands clamped to the bar. Sean stood there, breathing like a locomotive. His alien occupiers would stop him from buying more drink, but could not stop the gallons of Guinness in his gut from seeping through into his blood. Drop by drop, the ethyl alcohol oozed until his plasma could have been bottled and sold for gin. His eyes bulged with the battle for control, a battle lost. There was a tiny scream vanishing into nothingness, accompanied by a small popping sound as Mintical's grip slipped and his thought patterns vanished back among the stars. Portugal, the more experienced, fought on, but it was a losing battle, a defeat, an alcoholic Armageddon. As the synapses snapped open, he slipped away, vanished, cursing, back to the gunk-atmosphered home among the stars. Ah, Sean said, letting go of the bar and rubbing his sore hands one against the other. Experience counted. The amount of alcohol he had consumed would have killed a teetotaler in 12 seconds, would have preserved intact an entire family of hooded rats in a glass jar for centuries, but years of alcoholic overkill had won. What matter that his liver looked as though an entire regiment of the Irish Guards had marched over it with hobnailed boots? It was of little importance that millions of his brain cells had been dissolved into jelly so that his IQ had dropped by 20 points. None of this mattered. What did count was that the aliens had been repulsed and he had won. He drew himself up and for the first time in hours spoke with his own voice through vocal cords tired by the alien battle. It's quite a thirst I have. A pint, if you please. Good man, you had me worried there for a while. Had me worried as well, I assure you. He blinked away the alcoholic haze. My mind was taken over, it was. Possessed by first one strange creature and then another. That's it. By Jesus, that's what happened to me. I've been occupied. You've been drunk, Mulroney said, putting the dark pint down. I've been both, but no one will believe me. He sighed and drank. There were two of them, one nasty one, thick as two planks, wouldn't listen to the others pleading that his whole planet would be destroyed. Laughed, he did, nasty, pressurized little bugger. Sounds like a science fiction story to me. Why don't you write it down before you forget it? Sell it to someone, not me. I'll leave the storytelling to the lads who don't drink. A sober, teetotaling, serious lot, those science fiction writers, I hear. Set them up again, Mulroney, and one for yourself this time, for I'm beginning to disbelieve what happened myself. At this moment, as the pint filled full, far across the galaxy, a solid creature brooded unhappily at the bottom of a thickening sea, while still farther away, entropy ran out, and a dim star vanished with a tiny stellar scream. This is Laura Waterman, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona, reading science fiction.